he's gonna put some in some coin washing, he's gonna put some in mixing, he's gonna put some into buying alts, he's gonna put some into dark markets. You know, these guys are not stupid. He's gonna just find a bad, evil regime, and he's gonna go there in exchange for some gold bars or something. Who knows?
Hello, welcome to episode 38 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. It's always great interviewing a knowledgeable person who's not afraid to give an opinion, and Rodolfo Novak is that sort of guest. In this interview, we discuss CoinKite's early days, which started with a blockchain explorer, custom Bitcoin payment terminals, a widely used wallet hosting service, and a backend that utilizes hardware security modules of CoinKite's own design. With OpenDime, they've moved on to a fascinating new type of Bitcoin hardware that's best use cases are still to be determined. Rodolfo was also happy to give his opinions on many topical subjects. Hi, Rodolfo. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I feel like we have a lot to talk about. To start out, I'm really curious, what were you doing before you got involved in Bitcoin?
I can't remember if it was late 2010 or early 2011. My current business partner, Peter, he bumped into the Bitcoin white paper online and he shared with me, and we were pretty intrigued. At the time, it was just sort of like this interesting thing. This sounded too great to be true. And we were very skeptical at first and sort of like, you know, started following, but like slowly dipping our toes into it.
What were you guys doing before the Bitcoin? What were you guys partners doing?
We had a dev shop. We were making, you know, apps, some apps like the general applications for either customers or some for ourselves. And I had a startup at the time. I was doing a search engine for time series data for financial and any type of quant sort of analysis. You know, one of the things we added to the system was Bitcoin price. and this was like hard at the time because there weren't a lot of sort of sources for it, right? So in, I think it was like mid-2012, we were like, okay, this Bitcoin thing is really cool, very complicated. It seems to be kind of solid. I mean, the tech is there. So we were like, okay, let's make a project to learn more about it, right? So we created btclook.com. BTClook.com was a blockchain explorer, but a visual one. And in back in the day, there were only, I think, like 10 or 20 gigabytes of blockchain data. So we actually had the whole blockchain in memory. It was all in RAM. So you could traverse the whole blockchain in like milliseconds. It was a really cool tool. And we're like, okay, great. This tech is solid. This is interesting. We can't find a wallet we like. So let's make a wallet. We started, you know, playing around. We were like, okay, but, you know, wallets are great, but people need to be able to use this. So we started, you know, figuring out, you know, how can people use. The most natural thing at the time was, why don't we just integrate this into a payment terminal? Visa's been doing this for ages. We just put the tech in it and make it work. So we went to the Bitcoin conference in 2013 with a working CoinKite terminal. Showed a few people. There was some interest. And we came back and we're like, great. So people are starting to get a few of those machines from us, started to use it. But the biggest issue was there were no sort of safe ways of handling Bitcoin in scale. It's fine to put, you know, like Bitcoin in your Trezor, in your Ledger, or, you know, in your paper wallets. But the reality is that, you know, when you're running a business or you're running an exchange or something, you need liquidity and you need access to a lot of Bitcoin very quickly, and you need to do that safely. So we're like, okay, managing secure keys is not a new problem. Banks have been doing that for ages. You know, the NSA have been doing that for ages. Let's reach out to an HSM manufacturer and get, you know, a few boxes and, you know, manage keys that way.
What does it cost for that type of hardware security module?
I think like on the low end, they started like about 10,000 and then, you know, they go up to, you know, 100,000 kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Per box. They're expensive because, you know, they're super secure. They're also physically secure and they do a bunch of stuff that's very custom. What was interesting is that once we reach out to those manufacturers, right, none of them can do the Bitcoin curve because you don't want to be running arbitrary code into these machines. The whole point is like there is a chip in there that can do the curve that you want, right? So it sort of does the crypto in hardware, not in software. So the problem was none of them could do it. if they can't do it, then there is essentially no point. So we went out and we built a few HSMs ourselves for CoinKite.
How do you do the physical, I guess, tamper resistance or the self-destructive nature? How does that work?
There's multiple approaches, right? And sort of like multiple layers of security. There is a physical, actual physical security of the RAM, for example. You know, the RAM is epoxied, conformal epoxied, potted into the board so that you can't do cold boot attacks. And then it's got sensors so we know if there's pressure changes, if there's movement, if there's temperature changes. So somebody tries to drill something, you know, you can tell. So there is all this sort of like chain of sensors and also like chips that are not necessarily part of the original board that do some of that stuff outside of the control of the boot chain as well. So that, you know, if somebody manages to tweak something in the board, you know, the board knows that it's being tampered with in hardware and in software. So that's sort of what you're trying to achieve, right?
I find the whole thing fascinating, where the physical and the digital.
It's a lot of fun to make physically secured things. It's just not very cost effective. So we went out, we built a few of those because we needed to be able to support, you know, our customers, both key backup and key transaction signing. What's really neat about the model we had was the boxes were essentially kind of like a black box. They didn't really do anything but sign transactions with keys it knew or keys it protected. So all the business logic sits somewhere else, right, in a web server that's also secure, probably signed with a key from the HSM, that kind of stuff. So, you know, if somebody were to take access to even the web server, maybe they would be able to sort of like, you know, try to steal a customer account per se, but not never the actual Bitcoin crypto. The Bitcoin crypto was always sort of inside this dark black box. And that really raises the level of security to, you know, like state actor kind of thing. You'd have to, you know, have backdooring chips or sort of put guns into people's heads to kind of get into these things. And the way you get around that, it gets even more interesting. So for example, against rubber hose attacks, you know, for somebody that doesn't know that, it's like, you know, when somebody sort of, you know, takes physical access to an employee or something, right? And they're either, you know, physically or monetarily, how do you call it? Motivated to do something is you split keys, right? So then even if one has access, you can't really. And, you know, if you try to reboot, the box is dead. It's as good as garbage.
Is there much concern of some kind of a false flag destroying the data that you need? I mean, is there a lot of redundancy? How do you deal with that?
So what you do is you run those boxes in parallel, right? You essentially turn a bunch of them on. You destroy extra keys. And there is only a few keys to remake them from scratch. If one of them goes away, it's essentially paperweight.
I guess I can't think what happens if all of them go away, but I guess that's...
It just doesn't happen, right? You just have them in physically separated, like geographical separated solutions. And you also have keys to remake them.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Because, remember, right? So CoinKite had two sort of security models, right? One was we had a custodial sort of wallet that, you know, was super fast because it was not multisig. And it was used by a lot of companies to do sort of hall wallets. And then we also had the multi-sig approach, which, you know, then we wouldn't have all the keys. And that's where you kept your sort of cold funds, right? You would put two of your keys in cold storage and we would keep one of the keys always available to you. But we would do all the signing if you wanted. Or we could actually back up the keys provably and keep those keys inside the HSM for you as well.
How similar is what you do? And I don't even know the details of, say, a BitGo or...
We were substantially like more complex in terms of features. A lot of companies that were trying to do things that were either different or understood security, they would use us. So, for example, if you transacted any funds on Coinapult, for example, you know, all those funds would go through CoinKite. We were doing about 5 to 10% of all Bitcoin transactions.
Wow. When was this?
Like I'd say 6-7 months ago. We had about 4.5 million coins tracked in the system.
And that was both the multi-sig and the custodial?
Yeah, and Litecoin as well. We were essentially like the only place where people with meaningful amounts of Litecoin could store safely.
Interesting.
We had high availability. There were a lot of very interesting solutions that we had that nobody else could do or would do because you would increase their complexity a lot and nobody else had Bitcoin HSMs. So they can't really do what we did in the scale that we were doing. We had like 500,000 wallets and we were doing like an absurd amount of transactions per hour.
So what made you close all this down?
You know, we're a small team. We're technically inclined more than sort of a standard sort of Silicon Valley startup. We sort of never took funding. We did it all of ourselves. As you become bigger in this space, Bitcoin forces start to want to make you decentralized as just pure sanity. So, you know, we were under DDoS since the first day we started. But by like a lot of DDoS.
What were the motivations for DDoSing you?
Just unknown state actors. Who knows? I mean, we were the only wallet that was available to China and Russia over Tor. Even the API was available over Tor. Hmm. So we, you know, a lot of people in countries where you get in trouble, you know, they would use our system, including, you know, probably New York. Uh-huh. And we would not know our customers too, right? We had a pure tech play. It was not a financial company. So we didn't know our customers too.
How were you able to be custodial but not have that burden?
Because we never touched fiat, right? I mean, we were a pure Bitcoin play.
Okay.
The thing is, you can tell, like, a bad guy is often 10 steps ahead and they would use multi-sig. And we would not have any custody. And if we knew somebody was willfully doing something illegal, you know, we would kick them out. It's just we had no data on purpose, right? Our system was sort of like a black box.
But you did find out some people were doing something
So this is where, you know, so besides the DDoS, then you start getting, you know, like letters from multi-varying state actor three-letter agencies.
Oh.
Yeah. You know, requesting information, and, you know, we are not the kind of company that want to just give everything out. So not that we had a lot, but still, I mean, you know, we care. So, you know, like, there goes the lawyers sort of like, you know, reading all that stuff, and you have to review things. And then there is, you know, like, essentially for the amount of money you can charge for wallet services, right? It's not worth the headache. I mean, you know, like, you can make a very good, like, you can make a good business out of wallets. I mean, unlike what some people say, I mean, you can actually make money out of wallets because, you know, businesses want somebody else to hold the problem, so they will pay you for it. But at this stage, and in the spirit of Bitcoin, really, and this is the fascinating lesson to me, is like, Bitcoin wants to be, it wants to be free, right? It wants to be decentralized. And that's where, you know, we and everybody else should focus their energy on. It's like, make the solutions for the businesses to be able to automate safely themselves. Because what we were doing, if the businesses had an easier version to use of our backend, they could do it themselves. And sort of like, that's the path we're on now.
Could you say that you shut down services for the protection of your users just in case there was a three-letter agency wanting an IP address or something?
I think it's a holistic approach to closure. It was a multiple sort of thing, you know. I'm not the kind of person that, you know, want to spend, you know, my days as a company business person, you know, dealing with lawyers. I want to, you know, either make money or play with tech. This is a company from engineers to engineers, and we love that. We don't necessarily have the need to create the billion-dollar company.
Are you guys actively selling your hardware security modules to other companies?
We've been approached by quite a few. The main issue right now is making a product that's like realistically affordable and easy enough, safely enough to use by a business. Right now, the majority of the wallets out there, you know, their teams are going to look at this stuff. They're not going to know where to start, right? This is not easy tech. It's very low level stuff. And we would have to build some layers on top of this to make it easier. And there's also like finding a cost-effective physical hardware solution that's like cheap enough, which we are working on. I mean, it's sort of like I don't want to say a side project, but it's an ongoing project. We have like a bunch of exchanges, a bunch of wallets that sort of like, you know, we've been capturing, you know, what they want and sort of trying to figure out if it's possible, right? So that's sort of where we are with the HSM servers for businesses.
Do you believe other Bitcoin exchanges or wallets are using hardware security modules now?
There's multiple ways of using an HSM, and there really is only one right way of using an HSM, and I don't think anybody in the space is doing that right now.
Interesting.
See, you know, like, let's talk a little bit about Bitfinex. Why not? So, I mean, I only have anecdotal knowledge of that, right? Mm-hmm. Because I mean, my only talks with them were way back in the day in terms of sales, that kind of stuff. But if they were willing to let a provider have sort of like no stop signing on their end, they should have had HSMs on their end with the right controls signing the transactions for them.
Did you say no stop, S-T-O-P?
Yes, no stops, right? Because
can you explain what that means?
So the issue is, you know, apparently, as I understand, Bitfinex had, you know, two keys, one key from BitGo, whatever. And essentially, they had all the security features, all the velocity limits, all the limits off on BitGo. So when the hacker took hold of enough keys, he was able to transact everything out.
Why do you think those settings weren't enabled?
That is a question for their CTO. At the end of the day, there has to be a human there somewhere that is at least watching. I mean, you know, you have a graph that, you know, like here's a standard day in terms of, you know, in and out of money, right? And then here's another day where, you know, all of a sudden, like 90% of my funds are getting out. And then, listen, you run and you cut the plug of the thing of Caesars.
So what is your move when you see someone's draining your hot wallet or whatever, a wallet?
Okay, so I don't know fully what happened, right?
Sure.
It seemed like the attacker didn't have access to the actual Bitcoin keys. Because if he had access to the keys, he would just make one big transaction out, right? Or whatever fit into a single transaction in terms of bytes.
Okay.
It's sweeping that, right? He wouldn't have to like use the BitGo API or anything like that. He would just sweep the key into a new wallet. But it seemed like the hacker actually used BitGo's API, right, with Bitfinex keys to transact all the money out. You should be able to see in your business logic that there is something going on wrong, even if the limits are not on. You have to be able to look at that stuff and go like, wait, there is something wrong. Some alarms go off, even if things are still going. Shut everything off.
So, again, speculation only here, but do you have either through what you've learned or just through your thoughts, what exactly happened, how the hacker got a key?
I don't know. But, you know, there's always the usual way. That's what happens to most companies. It's hackers will get a hold of, you know, like one of the developers' sort of machine through malware or something, right? And then they'll dig out some keys from that machine, and then they'll go as deep as they can, and then they'll sort of start draining. I mean, once they sort of figure out as far as they can go in terms of getting access to things, they will sort of wait for something to happen that sort of will divert some attention, and then they'll get it. A Bitcoin company is essentially a piñata for hackers, right?
Sure. You got to have balls. Like, I mean, come to think of it, if you're going to declare to the world you own thousands or hundreds of thousands of Bitcoins, you got to be really feeling confident that you're doing the security right, I guess.
Exactly. Because, you know, unlike a bank, you can reverse it. Everything in the security industry never had to do with the fact that the server had the money. The keys that would help you sign another server to then send dollars out of a bank or something, right? But the actual money is in the actual string, right? Like in the actual server. So like security industry and the hardware and everything else needs to sort of learn a lot here and try to figure out what's the best way of going about this without bogging down business. You can't have stuff in cold storage, right, for a real business to operate. You need liquidity.
Bitcoin's really letting the experimentation and learning happen, I guess.
It is the most fascinating thing that there is to work on right now. I mean, like, there's a never boring day.
Today's magic word is HSM for Hardware Security Module. Enter the magic word to claim your share of this week's LTB Coin listener reward on letstalkbitcoin.com. Support the show by buying a Bitcoin keychain at bkeychain.com. This is the classic Bitcoin keychain you've seen all over the internet. It's a substantial coin-like medallion that you'll be proud to keep with you at all times. For those who love a pun in times of division, check out the Bitcoin Fork Pen at bitcoinforks.com. Bitcoin Fork Pens are sure to get a laugh at the next Bitcoin meetup or conference. Again, that's bkeychain.com and bitcoinforks.com. So, you want to talk about OpenDime?
Yeah. So OpenDime, I mean, so we've been toying with the idea of making, you know, hardware wallets and sort of consumer wallets for like years now, right? And we have like shelves worth of prototypes here.
Ah, that sounds fun to look at.
With screens, without screens, you know, with like cameras, all kinds of cool stuff. The main issue is it's always been sort of like, what's the model of use, right? Like, are we just making like a thing for people to just sort of like a Bitcoin coffin? So, you know, we were thinking about, you know, user needs and habits and, you know, and ease of use. And, you know, there are some great hardware wallets out there, and that's not what we wanted to make. We wanted to make something that is like stupidly easy to use. But like no software, nothing, right? Cheap, so that anybody could buy, and decentralized, right? So those were sort of the three pillars we wanted to approach for this product. So we were trying to figure out, hey, you know, like what if we could make a physical Bitcoin, like then, you know, we're fascinated by off-chain transactions because, you know, it's like privacy heaven, right? You know, you can just keep on passing on that same key to more people and more people and more people. But that has an inherent problem, right? Whoever created that key can always steal the money from the next person, right? Mm-hmm. So we were trying to figure out a solution, and sort of like OpenDime was really where we got at. You know, this is still a small sort of like, it's like a side project, right? And we had a decent production run, but it's still not, you know, a global production run. So the cost is still a little higher than we want to be. It needs some smarter sort of micro in there so that it could do the actual Bitcoin crypto in itself. But the whole point practically is you have a device that you stick it in your computer. It doesn't need any software. It just pops up. You add a file for Entropy. So any file from your desktop. It's super easy when you plug it in, you can see it. So it's provably a unique private key so that people know that CoinKite can't take it, OpenDime can't take that. It's not like previously generated.
Could someone using the same file get the same private key again, or is there other Entropy?
No. It's our Entropy as well. So it's a mix of Entropy from different sources.
And what's your source?
So in the hardware itself. And there is also some bytes there that we pre-populated. So there is a few different sources of Entropy there. There is a script that comes with it. If you want, you can prove it to yourself because the device can sign a message with the nonce that's in there. Now, you know, anybody can go plug it in. They have a Bitcoin wallet now, and then they could just drop in some money, right? There is a QR code and everything. And then you can just give it to somebody as payment, right? I mean, of course, this is not meant for people to put, you know, $100,000 in it and untrustfully give to somebody, right? Like the other person receiving it shouldn't trust that. But you know, if you have a bunch of them, each of them with like, you know, $1,000, $2,000 in it, or even less, and you know, they take these OpenDimes, they have some sort of like offline trusted mortar with you, like, you know, you either live in your city or there's other methods of remediation. But you get these OpenDimes, you can stick them in your computer, you can check the balances. And we're releasing a tool for Electrum as well, so you can check the device. So there's some authenticity there. So let's assume now you know, right? Like it's good enough for you that this device is what the other person said it is. So now you have a bare bond in your hands, just like you would have a pile of cash or a pile of gold. You have a pile of Bitcoin in your hand that you can trust. So now you can go to another person and sort of pass that along. And what's really neat is that there is no transaction tracking between the three of you or the 10 of you or the 100 of you, because it's all off-chain. We wanted to make this emulate flash drives. So it's literally a USB key. When you stick it in, the computer is going to see it as a USB key with just files in it.
So it'll look at the image and it'll say...
Exactly.
Got it. Okay.
It's auto-mount. And you would be, you know, there's like an index file there for you to open with explanation in multiple languages. And, you know, we generate a QR code that you can, you know, look at on the screen so you can pay from your phone. We were really trying to make this like as painless as possible and also without any proprietary software that needs to be installed. It's an appless sort of thing that works with everything. That was super important.
Where do you find the sources to actually manufacture these things?
We actually have a factory, you know, in China that does manufacturing for us. Mm-hmm.
And are there custom chips or how does that work?
We have a contract with a chip manufacturer that, you know, we'll sort of, you know, put together a batch for us with our source in it and that kind of stuff. When you're dealing with chip makers, you know, you have to sign all kinds of NDAs. You can't release everything open source. There's a bunch of barriers there. But yeah, I mean, you know, we have access to chip makers.
Can you explain a bit what you physically do to the device and how that releases the private key?
This is the fun part, right? I mean, why don't you physically break the device in order to spam? I mean, it's like, it feels great when you do it. There's very few electronics out there that you get to snap. So you essentially break this little middle tab. And what happens is the next time you plug it in, the micro is going to know that there is no connection there. And it's going to change itself to unsealed mode. And even if you went there and you re-soldered it or whatever, it doesn't matter, right? Like the micro has changed its own memory, burnt bridges there too. So like you can't really reverse the process. Which is really cool because then now it shows the private key, a big warning message. This has been unsealed. Don't deposit more money here. That kind of stuff. And then you can just load it in, like you can sweep it into any Bitcoin wallet. It's a standard Bitcoin WIF format. If this thing sort of gets bigger and it starts selling a lot and we can get enough scale that, you know, we can get a custom die chip, then you can make this into sort of like a banknote, you know, that has like a dabbed micro in it that you have to sort of rip or something. There's all kinds of cool stuff you can do if the scale is there.
So as I stare at this thing, I just keep going, okay, so what, how do you attack this?
Or yeah, no, I get it. It's like it's the private key is there. It's being invited, like, you know, please mess with me.
My first thought would be, and again, I just was fascinated by Casatius coins in the beginning and, yeah. And just the whole tamper-proof thing. So I'm wondering, like, how hard is it for someone to manufacture something that looks like this?
And so our micro is secure enough, and our source code is also encrypted in there. And also the technology for you to create something that emulates flashing is not easy. There's multiple barriers, right? Nothing is impossible. I mean, the same way, you know, an evil made attack could happen with a Trezor. Right. If you leave your Trezor in your home, somebody could come, replace the guts, and you would not know. Physical tampering is never 100%. It's all about threat models and amounts. If you have a lot of gold, you're not going to keep that in your counter, right? You're going to put that in maybe a big safe deposit box or something. You know, because even your gold can get replaced by tungsten with some layer of gold on top. There's never a perfect solution. This is actually one of the points kind of worth talking about. It's like, I kind of feel like the Bitcoin community gets very bogged down with the perfect solution. And this really sort of hampers progress in our industry. It's this idea that, oh, this has a flaw, therefore it's garbage, or it's not perfect this way. This is not the way you think about it, right? It's like, does this serve a purpose, right? Is this useful enough, even with some loss to some category of people or use, then it's needed. Right, it's a solution that's worth making. It's kind of like the same with, you know, I don't know, like hosted wallets. It's an important thing to have. Some people need it, or exchanges do need to hold funds. You can't solve every problem by saying cold storage. Not everything is cold storage, right? Or not everything you can make a backup of, right? So for example, OpenDive. The reason why we tell people not to use it for cold storage is because even though, you know, we trust our hardware, it's very well tested, you know, this thing is like rock solid, there is no backup. So, you know, you shouldn't be using this as long-term storage.
The real case is in-person, I guess, untrackable transactions with Bitcoin.
That's right. So, for example, or even in office. So let's say you're some big wallet that has, you know, 99% of your funds in cold storage. Why don't you just buy a boatload of these things and load each of them with, like, you know, $5,000-$10,000, and then every time you need more funds in whole wallet, you just break a tap and load it in.
You're saying $5,000-$10,000 you would trust of your own money to nothing going wrong on one of these?
I personally, you know, trust money in it.
Uh-huh.
But my point is, I always feel like people should only trust what they feel like in their gut that they should do, right? I mean, maybe after you use 100 open dimes yourself, maybe you're going to have more trust. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe you're just not somebody who's careful with hardware in general. You know, maybe you break this thing, you know, yourself. It really depends on the person. And with hardware, it's complicated, right? I mean, everybody breaks their iPhone screen.
Well, and as far as trusting, I remember just the first time creating a paper wallet and will this work and testing it. And then the first time I had like a few Bitcoins on one and redeeming it and like, oh, I please work.
That's right. Right. I mean, but it's also not impossible that mistakes happen or that, you know, defects happen or something happens. So it's important to always sort of spread your eggs. That's why this was designed for, you know, people to use multiple. And we actually make a point of selling only packs of three. So that, you know, we encourage that behavior.
So what do the open dimes sell for?
So they're, I believe, $12.50 each, and they sell in packs of three. We ship them by the cheapest shipping method to save people money, like standard post. Another reason why they're so thin, so that we can put them in envelopes. And, you know, we hope that in the future we can drop the price, tweak the technology. This is sort of V2, right? I mean, V1 was a small run. This one is a decent run. You know, it's selling, so we do have limited stock of this. And, you know, and with each version, we're going to sort of assess size and see if the technology is still the right one and sort of tweak. But the concept is there, right? Now you have something that, you know, you can give to somebody else that has the private key in it that you don't know. It's such a paradigm shift.
It's definitely cool. Yeah, I didn't really think that would be possible in something like so disposable.
But that's what crypto is supposed to allow us to do, right? Like crypto money. It's like everybody just keeps on trying to create the same or some allegory of the same. It's kind of like skeuomorphic versions of money, right? And it's not. Like, I mean, this is a completely different thing. It's digital money. Like, let's put chips in it and try to make it like do things, right? This thing has a gate. This money is spendable or unspendable physically. If this is the future form factor or not, it's like, you know, I want to see other things like this in the market. I want to see things that sort of, you know, are completely different.
I'm curious, have you thought about like non-cryptocurrency uses for having a private key like this?
I mean, technically you could, but there is already solutions for sort of, you know, like you can make a one-time use token. That's essentially what Bitcoin is.
That's, then it could sign
yeah,
things and stuff.
Okay. Exactly. Or you could have a pre-signed transaction in some of these. You could, I mean, there is a multitude of one-time use for tokens. But really, money is really where it's at because the value needs to be there for you to destroy something, right?
You were mentioning, I can't remember what it was, maybe an upgrade to the OpenDime. You were going to add some other feature. What was it?
I mean, this is only if the scale is there, right? I mean, you could make this into a flexible DAI. You could have this, you know, like the micro that's much cheaper, much smaller. You could maybe even be in a flexible note kind of thing, so it could look like money. The possibilities are there if the right scale is there because the budgets of making, you know, custom dies.
Okay, but no actual change to the functionality?
No, the functionality is there. It's sort of like we try to distill to the ultimate simple.
Yeah. No, I'm glad, actually. I thought you were saying you'd add some functionality. I was like, oh, what are you going to do? Okay, good.
I think, you know, it's early enough. It's kind of like when we created the terminals and we put them out there, right? Or we like sort of creating this thing that just, you know, there's they're sort of trailblazing things. They don't have like any precedent or any, you know, even when we're trying to add them to Bitcoin.org, right? You know, some developers, you know, expressed, you know, this is not a Bitcoin hardware wallet. Well, this is a new category. Let's add a new category. Let's add, you know, let's get these things in the hands of people.
I think it's admirable. Yeah, it's great.
So, yeah, I think that's it. Like, people use it and let us know, you know, how you're using and tweak accordingly.
Now, how do you feel if people are reporting that they're finding this really efficient for illegal activity?
I mean, people don't report illegal activity. Let's put it this way.
Well, maybe they'll use a euphemism instead of their illegal activity to explain how to use. Do you? I mean, are you curious about that kind of feedback?
No, I mean, okay. So here's the thing: use is use, right? I'm not interested in what you're buying with this. I'm interested in like the setting in which you're buying with this. You know, if you're meeting at McDonald's to buy, you know, something off of Craigslist or whatever, right? Like, how are you using it? What are you using to test it? Are you using multiples? You know, are you sending this preloaded on the mail? What are you doing? We want to understand the use logic, not necessarily the actual thing you're buying.
What kind of scale are you looking for to make that next leap in the manufacturing?
It's substantially more. The main issue is that Bitcoin is a massive market for some things and online. Other things are still growing, right? So we're in the thousands, right? We're still not in the millions, right? Or in the very high hundreds of thousands. We want to get there. If we get to enough that we can make a leap in technology, then yeah. But it takes a lot of sales for you to get into custom design of dies.
Are you able to divulge what your runs were for the first two?
Yeah, we don't release that. People get caught up in numbers. We made enough to be, because we're much cheaper, it's like almost like an unfair advantage. I'm certain we're almost meeting some of the numbers of our competitors for Bitcoin wallets, mostly because we're much cheaper and it comes in threes. But I think this last 2 months have been quite interesting, the amount of shipments. Huh. I know some of their numbers, and we're getting there.
Interesting. How do you know their numbers?
VCs talk a lot.
Oh. Well, obviously a very different use. And I saw that Twitter user, I guess it's Buten, he wrote a Medium post about just his love of your device.
Yeah, it's this idea, right? I mean, it's so rare when something is sort of like a paradigm-changing thing, or it's like a simple enough solution that is different enough. It doesn't happen that often, right? And it was very nice to see that when somebody gets it, like they really get it and they fall in love with this thing. It's just so simple and it's so useful for its purpose, right? So, you know, if you want to give some physical Bitcoin to somebody, this is it. I used to be a big fan of Consensus Coins, but the biggest problem has always been, you know, you have to trust who printed the private key.
Sure.
And, you know, that to me makes completely pointless. Like, the whole point of Bitcoin is you can't trust the private key.
You had to trust Mike and you had to trust it wasn't a fake.
And he's a complete upstand citizen. I mean, you know, like, and I'm certain you never, like, nothing will ever happen. But that defeats the purpose.
I remember seeing OpenDime, I feel like a couple months ago, and I don't feel like I've seen it just in the Bitcoin stuff I follow that much.
CoinKite was the same. I mean, we were doing 5, 10% of Bitcoin transactions, and we hardly ever got a lot of media attention. Mostly because, you know, we don't do PR and we don't have VCs.
You should get Michael Turpin involved and you have both. So that's why I was interested. I feel like, hey, this is kind of an underreported device.
So, well, I really appreciate it. This is great. That.
And you too. I couldn't find very many interviews with you.
We run a company it's very different, right? I mean, we're always heads down just coming up with stuff and playing with technology and sort of releasing it out there. The nice thing is we get enough use out of most things we make that they provide us with enough money not to need VC. And that's always a lot of fun. So we get to be unfocused. We don't go to conferences. We don't get that stuff. We're just busy. We're busy making.
You're not doing anything to become famous Bitcoiners.
We don't want to be famous.
Yeah. So I've got a whole bunch of kind of tangential questions. What's your feeling about like secure enclaves or protected computing that's on some or most, I guess, computers and smartphones.
It's crap. All these things have backdoors, and it's what was the name of the tech manufacturers tried to ship with it? There's like a secure micro that has some unique ID or some capacity of signing, but these things are never really, you know, they're not, you can't trust them. Simple as that.
Do you have opinions on a scaling path, block size, forks, payment channels, side chains?
Sure. Yeah. I'm pragmatic, but I'm very sort of like conservative with changes to native protocols. So I feel like, you know, we're perfectly fine as is for today. I'm completely okay with a very slow or no increase to block size, because, you know, well, really what makes Bitcoin so good is the fact that it's uncensorable and distributed, right? So as soon as you tack in more resource needs, like a big increase in block size or something, right, then it inherently makes it more complicated to run or more resource intensive, and that will make things, you know, less distributed.
Do you have any feelings about Ethereum in general and now the Ethereum versus Ethereum Classic?
Oh, man, Ethereum. So Ethereum has always been, I look at it always and sort of like, okay, this is like somebody's intellectual sort of endeavor, not necessarily a practical endeavor. I mean, it's not really Turing complete to begin with. And putting scripts on things that are immutable, I think it's unviable as is to the claims that he has. I think it's a, you know, it's a lot of fun. People should definitely go out there and try to make new things. Should not be disencouraged by it, but should definitely go out and try to make new things. But I just think, you know, the claims are bold and you know, the delivery is little. When, you know, forking, like destroying immutability, you essentially destroy your blockchain attempt. There is no point. If you're not immutable, use a database. Postgres now, I mean, supports all kinds of proofs, all kinds of you know, signing. You can do so much, you know, with a standard database. And then there is all sort of new cutting-edge database that can do even more interesting things. You can just use pure Merkle trees. You can, you know, use stuff like Git. If immutability is not what you're after, don't use blockchain. It's just a waste of time and money. It really is. I think it's more like a misplaced term. You know, what a lot of people mean by blockchain is really sort of cryptographic proofs. And that has, you know, it's just a small feature of blockchain. It's nice to see these experiments. But having a valuable, usable, immutable blockchain takes so much energy, so much cost, that is hard to believe there's going to be more than a couple in the world, at least for now. The reason why Bitcoin is so secure is because it's so decentralized. And to be so decentralized, it needs proof of work. It needs the cost that it takes to protect it. And that cost it takes to protect it also makes it fungible so that people can, you know, sorry, because it's immutable, it's also fungible, right? So you can't reverse because a bad guy used for something that you don't agree. Anyways, so, and these things are all sort of chained together. Like, you can't separate these little sort of features and logics by themselves and try to attack them and say, oh, proof of stake is better than proof of work. Well, it's not. And proof of stake has all kinds of problems, and it doesn't work by itself.
Let me ask you about the fungibility aspect. I've seen some people say, hey, you know, all those Bitfinex coins, they'll just track them, and, you know, I don't know if other exchanges would blacklist them. Do you think that's a possibility?
Every time there's a major theft, you know, the exchanges cartel, for lack of a word, sort of get together, you know, and you know, listen, they're trying to do the thing that sounds the more moral thing and the nice thing, right? I'm not making a moral argument. But the thing is, they do sort of like, you know, they will tag those coins, they'll not accept those coins, right? It seems like the decent thing to do if that's aligned with your financial incentives, right? Mm-hmm. But the reality is that the majority of Bitcoin doesn't go through exchanges or like official exchanges. I mean, the majority of Bitcoin goes through, you know, like dark markets and off-chain transactions, and which are completely uncounted for. In jurisdictions where, you know, the way that, you know, we have law in North America doesn't apply. And, you know, like this guy is going to get his money. You know, he's going to find a way of converting it. He's going to pay a price like most bad guys do. You know, it's essentially money laundering, right? Like he's got a bunch of bad money and he's going to launder it into, you know, good coins. Who knows? Maybe he doesn't even want dollars.
Have you had a large order of open dimes lately?
Well, if he's hearing and he needs some open dimes, you know, opendime.com. No, but seriously, he will find a way of converting that back because Bitcoin is so fungible. He's going to put some in some coin washing. He's going to put some in mixing. He's going to put some into buying alts. He's going to put some into dark markets. You know, these guys are not stupid. He's going to just find a bad, evil, you know, regime, and he's going to go there in exchange for some gold bars or something. Who knows?
Right? There you go. Are there any other altcoins that interest you?
I really just focus on Bitcoin.
Fair enough.
Technologically wise, I mean, you know, if Zcash wasn't sort of an American company and so centralized right now, you know, they do have interesting crypto, interesting tech. What else? I guess that's the main problem. There really isn't a lot of stuff out there to look at that's realistic or that doesn't make absurd, bold claims. And I guess definitely not OneCoin.
Seems pretty clear to anyone in Bitcoin about that. Do you ever contribute anything to CoreCo?
No.
Or nothing like that? Nope.
No. So we did contribute to PyCoin a bit. Contributing to open source takes a lot of energy. And, you know, there's people out there who are smarter than I am and who have the open source stamina to to lobby their fork or lobby their ideas through the open source hurdles, which, you know, it is supposed to be that way. I love what the core devs do and how hard it is for things to change, and you want that resiliency. They're smarter and they have more time and energy to put into that.
You've done a lot of really cool stuff. Any hints on what we're going to see next from you?
So we have the Bitcoin servers, right? They were trying to make it into a product.
So the servers are hardware security module servers?
They're going to be sort of like a hybrid. We're trying to find the cost-effective solution for people to hold and transact reasonable amounts of funds in a business setting. Because what's there is not realistic. You know, it's not easy to back up. Writing down your paper in paper, your seed words, it's not realistic for a business. You know, like there's chain of ownership, chain of management for these things. You can't trust anybody. It's complicated, right? I mean, like Trezors and Ledgers are great solutions, but in a business setting with multiple employees and treasurers and, you know, controllers, and who has access to a key and how do you keep backups? And, you know, it's complicated. These things need to be managed by computers with humans overseeing, not the opposite. That's one of the paths we're working towards.
That's it as far as stuff you're going to tell me you're doing?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there some stuff you're not telling me too?
We don't want to hype too much, but, you know, like everything we're making now is decentralized. So, you know, fully decentralized, or at least SPV. OpenDime doesn't require any central authority or apps. The new terminals, the servers won't need any central authority. The same, you know, if we make this other solution too. We really like open standards for hardware, even if some parts are not open or some, but there's still certain, you know, things that are off the shelf so that, you know, it's future proofing a little bit. So you can, you know, you have something that's going to last a long time, especially when you talk about backups. It's important for you to be able to go 10 years later, you know, and still be able to open a backup.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it'll be neat to see what you come up with. I think it's really admirable, all the work you're doing. It's kind of cool. You know, you're just doing it, not talking about
it. Yeah, we have fun. I think that's, at the end of the day, man, that's, you know, it's the first time you can have fun with fintech.
Are there any websites or social media accounts you'd like to mention?
Yeah, so I mean, we're pretty focused on OpenDime now. So just go to opendime.com and buy some, play around. We have it in stock right now, for now. So take us as long as we have and play around. Let us know if you're looking for the Bitcoin server. Go to coinkite.com. And I believe we have a sign up list there somewhere. If you don't, just email us or at OpenDime on Twitter. And let us know what you think.
So I'm going to try to barter with you now. Would you like to barter some really nice Bitcoin keychains for some of your open dimes?
Sure. Just send it over. We'll send it as your address. We'll send you a pack.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for coming on the show. I'm really excited to see what you guys do next and what people come up with open dimes.
Thanks, man. This was very nice. Bitcoin.
I hope you enjoyed the interview. Come by the show notes page to find some links to topics we discussed, and it's also a great place for you to comment on the episode. I'm the BTC Game on Twitter, and you can scan through my past episodes at thebitcoingame.com. See you next time.